Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How should a nation honor its war dead? Arlington National Cemetery is the final resting place for more than 400,000 active duty members of the military, veterans, and their families. Hundreds of Americans who died as a result of their service in Iraq, Afghanistan, or elsewhere in the War on Terror are now buried there as well, in a five-acre area known as Section 60. As my guest today has discovered after visiting regularly for years, Section 60 has a very different feel than areas filled in previous decades. It is a place where graves and grief both are fresh, but also a place where loved ones tend to remain actively engaged, where fellow soldiers come to mourn friends and process their own losses. Robert M. Poole is former executive editor for National Geographic and author of the new book, Section 60 Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Will you start by describing Section 60 for us, where it is within Arlington National Cemetery and how it was designated as the final resting place for some of the service members who died in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yes, it is. Section 60 is sort of on the fringes of Arlington Cemetery, which has been in existence since – the cemetery has been in existence since the Civil War, 1864. The first military burial occurred there. And the new graves are added sort of radiating out from the center of Arlington. At the center of Arlington is the old Robert E. Lee Mansion. That's where General Robert E. Lee lived before he went to fight for Virginia in the Civil War. His family lost Arlington. It became a cemetery. Each war has added rings around the old mansion, so that now the extent of Arlington Cemetery is about 620 acres plus. This one part of Arlington, Section 60, is about 14 acres, so a very small part of the larger cemetery, but one that's very distinctive. And one where many of the people who died in Iraq and Afghanistan are buried together, side by side. They're all there. They're concentrated there. And you see this in other parts of Arlington as well, where you can sort of walk through the history of a war, a recent war, or an older war going all the way back to the Civil War. Someone decided when we began sending troops into Iraq in 2003 that we would bury anybody who came back from that war who wanted to be buried at Arlington, that they would be buried together so that everybody would be in the same place. The same also applied to Afghanistan. People started getting killed in Afghanistan and brought back. They concentrated them in this part of Arlington.
The first person whose story you share in the book is a young man named Russell Riptow, whose own father was disabled in Vietnam but survived that war. How did Riptow become the first casualty of the Iraq War buried in Arlington?
Well, it was just largely by chance. He was just the first to die in Iraq and to get back to Arlington. That's where he wanted to be buried. If the worst happened, he wanted to be at Arlington. Just because of its prominence in the national story. Everyone who goes to war, it fills out paperwork, which there's a section of the paperwork where you say where you want to be buried if you are killed in wartime. So he filled that paperwork out. He asked to go to Arlington if anything happened. He was with one of the first waves to go into Iraq in March of 2003. He was an Army Ranger. He parachuted into Iraq, and he and his men from his squad were manning a checkpoint near the Haditha Dam. A car came up. A woman stepped out of the car and started waving her arms around. She was begging for food and water. Riptow saw this woman. He felt sorry for her. He asked one of his soldiers to bring food and water for this woman and her friends. When they got to the car, boom, that was the end of Russell Riptow. He was blown up. His father, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, also an Army Ranger, said later, my son's big heart killed him. He was trying to help this woman. But in many ways, that first burial at Arlington from the Iraq War gave a preview of the sort of war that this would be. The enemy would not be in uniform. The enemy would be blending in with civilian population. It would be hard to tell friend from foe, and you wouldn't be lining up in orderly lines of battle and facing off. It would be what we now call asymmetrical warfare, and that has played out, and it's brought many other variations of the what happened to Russ Ripito have happened to many others who are now buried with him at Arlington Cemetery.
Yeah, one sad fact of many of the deaths in the War on Terror has been that IEDs, improvised explosive devices, do such violent damage that in many cases families are forced to choose to bury their loved ones without seeing the remains. What did you learn about how that affects the grieving process and how families make the decision when given the option one way or another?
Well, ultimately, the policy is that it's ultimately up to the family. If you want to see the remains for the last time, it's up to you. That's your decision as a family member, as next of kin. But because the damage to these young men and women is so catastrophic, many times families are advised against seeing a son or daughter or husband for the last time. And that interrupts what is part of the grieving process to have some contact for the last time, just to see the person, to make sure that person is your son or your husband or your daughter. That is denied to many families from Section 60, and it's tough for them. They miss that, but at the same time, most of them understand why. It's probably more upsetting to see a loved one in that condition than to not see the loved one at all.
There's a lot of heartache to be found in Section 60, and that part of the book didn't surprise me. I was surprised to discover the extent to which it's also a place of healing and even a place of community for survivors.
Yes. I mean, there's a great community, the community of the living. In Section 60 is quite remarkable. People help each other out. They will seek one another out. If a mother can see that another mother is having a tough time, she'll go over and talk to this person she never met before and say, hey, tell me about your son. My son died last year under these circumstances. Let's try to get through this. Let me know if I can do anything to help. People try to help each other through the transition. They also make a point of not everyone who is buried in Section 60 has family close by. I mean, people may live, halfway across the country. And families who are closer to Arlington will volunteer to take flowers, objects, letters, teddy bears, whatever the distant family wants, the local family will do its best to take to someone's grave just to honor that person and to help with the transition and to show the world that someone remembers this person who's in the ground at Arlington.
Bob, you had already written a general history of Arlington National Cemetery a few years ago. What told you that you weren't done telling this story and that you wanted to return to Section 60?
Well, the book I did before this one, it was published in 2009, On Hallowed Ground, is the full history of Arlington Cemetery, which starts with the Civil War and comes right up to the present. While I was doing research for that book, I sort of stumbled into Section 60 as the first burials were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I could see this is different. You see something going on here that's not going on anywhere else in the cemetery. and the emotion, the feeling is much closer to the surface. Whereas maybe in other parts of the cemetery, someone would be buried who served in World War II, who lived a good long life, lived to age 90. There's, you know, you never want to go, but everybody has to eventually. It seems more natural mm-hmm. at that age. Whereas Section 60, they're mothers at the graveside with, you know, toddlers who've been born, who will never know a father, families torn apart, just trying to figure out where do we go from here. And for me, it was a way to tell individual stories about some of the people who were lost in Iraq and Afghanistan so that their names survive, so that some of the remarkable things they did survive, and so that they won't be lost, their names won't be lost, their memories won't be lost. It's sort of a my memorial to those we lost in the past two wars.
How did you make the rounds as a visitor while you were doing research, and under what circumstances would you strike up a conversation with people you saw?
Well, just for starters, my rule was to show the utmost respect for the dead and for the people left behind, for the survivors. And the way I did that, for starters, was I would dress for the part. If you go to an Arlington service, you will see Marines, soldiers, airmen, sailors, all turned out for this special occasion as a gesture of respect to the person who's being buried. Their shoes are shined, their creases are sharp, they have it together. So while I would never aspire to be on the level of these honors teams, I made sure that, you know, I wore a suit, I wore a white shirt, I wore a tie, a dark, you know, sober tie. My shoes were shine. So just from the start, I would show respect. Then when I approached someone, I never pushed anything too far. I would just sort of feel out a person if I met someone at Arlington. And my basic gauge was eye contact. If the person made eye contact and held it for more than a couple of seconds, then I would begin a conversation. If not, I backed off. I left them alone to, you know, do whatever they wanted to do in peace at Arlington. What developed was that most people, if approached respectfully, were very eager, not only happy, but eager to talk about what happened to a son or a husband or a daughter, how they got to Arlington, why they went into the Marines or the Air Force. It's a way of, I think it's therapeutic for people to talk. And it's a way to keep the name out there. People have even the people who were buried at Arlington, have some sort of life after burial. This is a way to carry on that life, to keep their names alive.
My guest is Robert M. Poole, former executive editor for National Geographic and author of the new book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. You can join the conversation now at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
¶¶
That is a section of Taps being played at Arlington National Cemetery. My guest this hour is Robert M. Poole, former executive editor of National Geographic magazine, author of the new book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Just so you know, KERA will be airing the radio special Coming Home, Stories of Veterans Returning from War, tonight at 8 o'clock. Bob Poole, I have to tell you, I smiled a bit to read about how much alcohol is shared with the residents of Section 60. And it turns out the tradition of pouring one out for a fallen comrade has ancient roots among warriors.
Yes, that goes all the way back, as far as we can go, to the time of Homer writing in the Iliad when Patroclus dies in wartime. His best friend Achilles mourns him, and one of the things that Achilles does right away is to pour wine into the ground for his best friend. This is a tradition you see repeated day after day after day in Section 60. People also bring cigarettes, cigars, snuff, things like that. Just who knows why, but I think when someone dies, you feel helpless. You want to do something. It's a way to do something. It's a gesture to maybe ease someone's passage from this world into whatever lies beyond. People do it every day.
And of course, it's not technically allowed. You have a story in the book of a mother who came to share a beer with her son, who was interred at Arlington. And I guess she sort of stared down the guard who tried to politely remind her of the rule against alcohol.
Yes, this was a great person who became a friend while I was reporting this book, doing the research for this book, Mary Coyer from Saginaw, Michigan. She and her husband and daughter drove all the way out from Saginaw to Washington to visit their son, Ryan, who was a soldier buried in Section 60. And among the traditions they observed was to bring a bottle of beer or a couple of bottles of beer and pour some into the ground for Ryan and some into mom or dad, just to, you know, as a way of communion of a sort, one for me, one for you. Mary was doing this one day, and some young cop doing his job came over and reminded Mary that you weren't supposed to have bottles here. You're not supposed to have alcohol here. So she looked him in the eye, poured what remained of the bottle into the ground, and what remained after that into herself, and handed this cop the empty bottle. And she later said, no way was that guy going to get Ryan's beer.
The other thing that's really unusual about Section 60 is the variety of objects that are left behind. I think I have visited Arlington National Cemetery and been struck by the uniformity of most of the grave sites. Section 60, the rules are bent a little bit in terms of what can be left there.
Yes. Well, the rules are that something like this. You can bring flowers, real flowers, during the months that flowers grow. You can bring artificial flowers in the months when, you know, in the winter months, mm-hmm. when artificial flowers are not to be had. And that's pretty much it. Those are the rules. And it makes sense. I mean, you can see the thinking is that when someone thinks of Arlington Cemetery, they think of white tombstones all lined up, very tidy, very neat, very soldierly, lush green grass. That's the aesthetic. That's what you want it to look like. Section 60 turns that upside down, and I think it's been a struggle for the people who run Arlington to deal with these families who bring all kinds of stuff to Section 60, letters, medals, cartridge cases, pictures, football tickets, birthday cards, birthday balloons. People come there to celebrate a son's birthday or a husband's birthday. Birthday cake. it's very exuberant in a way, but it is technically a violation of the rules. And several months ago, the people who run Arlington decided to crack down and started just without any warning, hauling all this stuff away. Families were very upset. They felt they were being treated like criminals, you know, just because they were bringing things for some departed son, some departed husband. The cemetery officials tried to sort of tone things down. But the long and short of it is that they have announced if you bring stuff there, you can't, if you want to bring, let's say, a high school picture of your son, you can bring it there, you can leave it there, but you can't glue it to the tombstone. You can't tape it to the tombstone. If you bring perishable items, birthday cake, that's going to be gone. We're going to, you know, we're going to snap it up. It's going to go away. We're not going to let this look like a junk pile. And so that's sort of the, it's sort of an uneasy truce between the families who want to continue bringing things, carrying on memorials. This is the only memorial for the Iraq or Afghanistan wars at this point. They bring the sorts of things to Section 60 that you see people bringing to the Vietnam Wall across the Potomac River. And there has been some effort on the part of the Army Department, Center of Military History, to archive some of these things. So there's a record of, for future historians, what did people bring? Why was it important? What does it tell you about these wars we have been fighting for the past 10 years?
There's actually a project underway by historians to try to get a photograph to associate with the name on every tombstone at Arlington National Cemetery.
Yes, the Center of Military History, one thing that they resolved to do out of this the recent wars was to make sure there's a photograph of every person who is buried in Section 60, so that you have a face to go with a name. So every couple of weeks, an archivist from this Center of Military History goes through this section of Arlington and collects photos and other items that are considered of historic interest. Because in some earlier wars, especially World War I, a lot of young men and women were killed. We don't know what they looked like. So this is a way of trying to make up for that, trying to make sure there is a historical record in one place where people can find it for future historians writing about Iraq and Afghanistan.
You know, Bob, the idea of families wanting to bring things and folks at the cemetery saying we need to maintain some decorum here, it's interesting because it really points to the larger tension between what Arlington National Cemetery is, right? On the one hand, it is a national memorial that we can all come to, even if we've never known anyone who is interred there. On the other hand, you know, when you are grieving someone, your needs are different and the things that you want from their final resting place might be different, at least temporarily.
Yes, and I think it is. I think the big point is that it is temporary. And just in the course of this project, you could see the objects moving from one end of Section 60 to another as the wars went on and new graves were added and people begin to heal in some way. They don't come as often. They don't bring as much stuff. You could see that moving through, over the ground, through this part of Arlington. But there is that tension built into the very nature of Arlington National Cemetery. It's a national cemetery. It began as a military cemetery. It's run by the Department of the Army. And they have a certain attitude about how things ought to be done. At the same time, it is a public place. Anybody can go visit there. Any place you want to go in Arlington, you can go. 4 million people come there each year. 4 million people who come to Washington. That's part of the tour that they make. So there is this built-in tension between a public place, a private place for grieving, an army cemetery, even though people from other services are buried there. That's all built into the institutional nature of Arlington Cemetery.
Among the veterans buried at Arlington are some who served in Iraq or Afghanistan and ultimately took their own lives.
Yes, there are several in that category. And one of the things I tried to do with this book was to tell a few selective stories so that I'm writing not only about an individual, but about some larger issue. For instance, what IEDs do, how they work, how that has changed the nature of warfare, how that affects families grieving. The same with some of the invisible injuries that people return from war with PTSD, traumatic brain image, post-traumatic stress disorder. And most people diagnosed with PTSD survive it. They do okay. They carry on. It's not like a death sentence. It's not like you're doomed to failure just because you've been to war, just because you're having trouble making the transition from war to peace. But some people don't make it, and I wanted to address that, and I did that in one section of this book where I talk about a very admirable Green Beret who served a long time. He served many deployments. He was a very accomplished Army medic, and he was in Iraq many times. He was in Afghanistan many times, and it just built up and built up. And his family tried to get treatment for him. He did get treatment, but he didn't stick with it. And the reason he didn't stick with it was that he thought it would kill his career as a Green Beret if anyone knew he was having problems with depression and PTSD. And from the top down, the word is it won't affect your career. You should report it. You should get treatment. But at the operating level, I think it takes a bit longer for everybody to buy that story. And in any event, this gentleman, who was a Master Sergeant, Sean Mokaby was his name, took his own life, and he is one of the characters in Section 60.
The book also gives you an opportunity to explore how the U.S. military has struggled with acknowledging the reality of fratricide, or so-called friendly fire, and the effects that it has. Can you tell us a little bit about Private First Class David? Is it Sherritt or Sherritt?
Sherritt. Mm-hmm. David Sherritt. Yes, David Sherritt was killed in Iraq by friendly fire. Although his family did not know that for a long time. They knew he had been killed. They were led to believe that it was from enemy fire. To make a long story short, this is, for obvious reasons, an issue that many of the services have been reluctant to address. It's embarrassing. It's messy. You don't want your own soldiers or Marines or whatever killing each other when you go to war. But it happens, and it's been a part of wartime since wars began. You go back to George Washington's day. He said the closest he ever came to getting shot was from musket fire from his own men. Some confusion. The fog of war, confusion of wartime. In any event, friendly fire is a part of war. It has sent several people to Section 60, and I wanted to explore the case of David Sherritt and the dedication his father followed to get to the truth. He just wanted to find out as a a salute to his son, an honor to his son. How did he die? How did this happen? And he did that. This was a high school English teacher who took on the army and butted heads with a long line of generals and finally got the truth about what happened to his son. He visits him regularly now in Section 60, and it's, nothing can bring the son back, but it was his way of paying tribute to his son and letting him know he did the best for him. He tried to get answers from the big guys.
You saw on your visits, you witnessed lots of conversations between living loved ones and, speaking to the person they've lost.
Yes, this happens all the time. And, you would be probably considered crazy doing this anywhere else. But in Section 60, it's quite normal. People would be, a woman would be sitting on a tomb picking up a conversation that she left off last week with a son or a husband, talking about football games, talking about how things were, what's happening to other members of the family. And it is, I don't know why people do this, but I think it's probably therapeutic. And I think that this is a place where you have a point of contact between the community of the living and the community of the dead, and it's normal to behave that way in such a place. That's what makes Section 60 special.
We're speaking this hour with Robert M. Poole, former executive editor for National Geographic and author of the new book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Ready! Hey! Fire! Ready! Hey! Fire! Ready! Hey! Fire! Hey, set!
Out! 21-gun salute at Arlington National Cemetery on this Veterans Day. We're speaking with Robert M. Poole, a former executive editor for National Geographic and author of Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Bob, I was really fascinated by the chapters you devote to the professionals, the military units who have made it their work to ensure that their comrades their fallen comrades are laid to rest with dignity. Can you talk, first of all, about their attitude to making every service special, whether it is for that, 90-year-old veteran who has not been active in decades or someone who died just recently in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Yes. These are honors teams who work at Arlington every day. And it works this way. If you're a Marine, you have fellow Marines carry you to the grave, fold your flag, the flag from your coffin, and fire the rifle salute and play taps. The last honors you get will be from uniformed members of your service. Same with the Navy, same with the Army, same with the Air Force. So many of these people are in the Washington, D.C. area, and they are of the same age as the people they are burying. Many of them served in Iraq or Afghanistan, so they've been there. They're not, they're not just there for honors alone. They've been there. They know this could be me in the ground here. They're very professional. They're very keen on their role at Arlington. They know that an Arlington service is probably going to be one of the days that someone will remember, some member of that family will remember for the next 20 years or the next 30 years or the next 40 years. So they want it to be done with precision. They want it to be done beautifully. They spend hours practicing folding flags so that you're converting the familiar red, white, and blue rectangle into a tight blue triangle with just white stars showing, the flag is folded up after the service, at the end of the service, and handed to the next of kin. They take great, great care in how that's done. It has to be done at just the right speed. It has to be done with the right snap. The handoff has to be flawless. They're very meticulous about their appearance. They wear, they make sure their shoes are shined to a high sheen. Their uniforms are pressed. Their medals are aligned. They're going to be turned out looking sharp for this person they may not have ever met. They probably did never meet, but it's a brother or sister in arms, and they're going to give them a good send-off. The people who do this think about, some of them think about, well, you know, this could be me. I'm lucky I got back. I'm going to try to do the best job I can do for this fallen comrade. And you see, even in some of in the ground at Arlington in Section 60 and in these honors teams, you see some changes in the services. For instance, women get closer and closer to combat, you find more of them under tombstones at Arlington. Women have died in Iraq. Women have died in Afghanistan. They've taken their places there alongside the men. Helicopter pilots, nurses, people who serve in clerical jobs near where the fighting is taking place, they're all represented at Arlington. And you're also beginning to see in some of the honors details, women are in the firing parties, in the marching platoons, and there's a woman, a pretty remarkable woman, who is on the casket team for the Air Force honors team. She can bench press, everything the guys can do. She can carry her weight. She's there every day doing service for a fellow airman who have come to Section 60. So you see all these things during the course of an Arlington ceremony.
That is impressive that there's a woman on that team because, as you explain in the book, these guys, you know, part of their workday is working out, and most of them are 250-pound sort of linebacker-looking people who carry these heavy coffins.
Yes. Well, you know, there is a, the Marines do everything the Marine way. They do things a little differently. So other services will have an 8-person casket team carrying the casket, you know, on its last journey from the caisson or the hearse to the ground at Arlington. The Marines have 6 people on a team, 3 on each side. So, you know, they're proud of doing more with less, and they recruit these guys who look like they could play for the NFL, huge guys who, you know, lug around these caskets and make it look easy.
They have to maintain a certain level of detachment in order to do this work, but they told you it gets harder to maintain when there's a child there to bury a parent.
Yes. This is one of the things that really impressed me about all across the board, all of these honors teams. These families are falling apart, and you will see time after time the people who are carrying the caskets, firing the salutes, playing taps, all of the things we associate with an Arlington service, they've got it together. They are in control. They are stone-faced. They're sober. It gives you a sense of order among the chaos of that moment for your family. It's very, very striking. But even so, some of them told me, you get back to the barracks and, you know, it's all you can do to hold it together if there's, a toddler there at the graveside saying, Mommy, you know, why is Daddy in the box? Where's Daddy?
Hmm.
What can you say?
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who wants to know if you've sensed that anger among loved ones is somehow more present for those burying individuals from more recent wars, including Vietnam. And do you see people searching for someone to blame in order to deal with their loss?
Not so much. No, the short answer is no. I didn't see much of that. What I heard about from a Marine who was in one of these honors teams, he said that he's doing what I just described. He's there. He's running a funeral, and he is above the fray, standing tall, you know, looking like a good Marine. And there are members of the family who single him out, and you know, they're looking for somebody. The family is looking for somebody to blame. And I guess because this is the ranking Marine around, people will look at him and sort of blame this guy who's just there to run a funeral, to stage a funeral, give somebody final honors. But the families, some families sometime feel a need to lash out, and their anger is directed at whoever happens to be standing there.
You've noted that many people who are not coming to visit a loved one or a past relative, you know, hit what amounts to like the greatest hits areas of Arlington National Cemetery, and you think that's a mistake. Can you talk about what we can get by staying longer than just seeing the Tomb of the Unknowns or the flame at the Kennedy grave?
Well, I think if you consider the hundreds, several hundred thousand people buried at Arlington, every one of those is an individual with an individual story, a family story, quite often a fascinating war story. And I've been going there for many years. Every time I go to Arlington, even after all these years, I learn something new. It's like it's a time capsule where you can find out about our recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you can walk through the Civil War out on the edges of Arlington Cemetery. Just by walking around the cemetery, you learn things. You look at the ages on the tombstones of the first young men who died in the Civil War. Lots of New Englanders, lots of very, very young people. They're there on the fringes of Arlington, laid to rest. Just up the street from them, you walk through a section that you see incised on the tombstones these initials, USCT. What does that mean? That means U.S. Colored Troops. These are black Civil War soldiers who fought for their country, who fought for their freedom, segregated in death as they were in life. And it's a very powerful history lesson of those times. You see this reflected throughout Arlington. We strive to do better. We strive to evolve. But Arlington reflects the values of the time. And you see that walking through the cemetery from one section to another. And you'll see that in some ways in Section 60, what was important to people at that time.
I know there's a little online app that you can use to look up someone, the site of whose grave you would like to find. Is there also a place to learn details about the lives of all of these, particularly men, but also women buried at Arlington?
I don't know of a place. It would be, someone suggested, a Navy chaplain suggested to me, wouldn't it be great if someone developed such an app so that you go to, say, Russell Ripito's grave, and there's a barcode on the grave, and you put your iPhone up against the barcode, and it gives you a little biography of who is this guy, what did he do.
Yeah.
So I encourage you to go to work on that.
Maybe when I retire. What's going to happen, Bob, when Arlington fills up? I mean, there's finite space there, and it's sad to think about the need for more, but there are also surviving veterans who will ultimately be buried there. So what are the plans?
Well, the big picture is that the people who run Arlington think we can go another 50 years with the land we have or are in the process of developing. So I mentioned earlier, Arlington is something like 620 acres now. It will be close to 700 acres in the next 10 years. That's from tearing down old World War II era buildings adjacent to Arlington, taking over that land. So there's something like 70 acres being added to the existing acreage. So that's, you know, that'll free up some space. And I should say, you know, we don't want to fill it up, but, you know, it's inevitable that it probably will be filled. There's also something that's happened in the past 20 years, probably. It used to be nobody wanted to be cremated. It was not considered a good way to be buried.
Mm-hmm.
That has changed in the past 20 years, so that there's a new section of Arlington adjacent to Section 60, which is called a columbarium. And in that section, there are niches where people's cremated remains are stored. And that, because we're able to do that and because people are willing to be inurned rather than buried, that frees up a lot of space in the ground for those who qualify for ground burial and, you know, still want that. So anyway, maybe another 50 years, we think Arlington will keep going. And who knows after that? I mean, there's always the there's a big parking lot around the Pentagon. Maybe that could be developed in some way. It's right next door.
Robert M. Poole is former executive editor for National Geographic, and he's author of the new book, Section 60, Arlington National Cemetery, Where War Comes Home. Bob, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Mashal Noor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.